Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. You know, I love talking to authors because they have the courage to take their thoughts, put it down on a piece of paper, share that piece of paper with the world, and it can change everything about their legacy and their destiny. And so, you know, if you're looking to write a book out there, check out dreamstarterspublishing.com. And if you have a book that's already done, you want to use it as a marketing tool, check out bookmarketingcrm.com. The book that we're talking about today is perfect for you out there. If you're looking to grow or even start a business, you want to become an advisor. You want to gain that trust from the marketplace. And we have an individual who wrote a book that has almost 1,500 reviews. The book is called The Trusted Advisor. And, I guess this is the 20th anniversary that is available. So it's on Audible. So if you guys are looking to just listen to a book on that run or on that drive, pick it up. But if you want to become a trusted advisor, this podcast is for you. We have one of the authors with us, Charles Green. Thanks so much for being here, man.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off with the genesis of this book. And I'm going to flip it over to now Charlie and make it a little bit more informal. But what made you want to sit down with, I guess, David and Robert and a couple other people to put this book together?
It was a kind of a natural outgrowth. I just, to give a quick backstory, I had an undergraduate degree in philosophy. I got an MBA from Harvard Business School. I spent 20 years in management consulting. And when I left that firm, it was sort of, what do I do now? And I kicked the idea around with my friend, Rob Galford, who's one of the three co-authors, as you mentioned. And we were both doing a little bit of freelance corporate training. And we came up with this idea of, expanding in the idea of a trusted advisor. The word was already out there. This is back in the late 90s. So we didn't invent it. It had currency. You already couldn't copyright the term. It was that useful. But nobody had written a book on it. And we envisioned it dealing with clients like professionals, lawyers, accountants, consultants. B2B sales came later. And we kicked around ideas. We couldn't find a publisher, couldn't find an agent. At the time, all the big business books were data-based, like Good to Great and Search of Excellence, that kind of thing. And we thought, no, this is more of a wisdom book. And all the agents said, that'll never sell. And then we ran into David Maester, our third author. David had already written half a dozen books. And he said, gee, that's interesting. I'm thinking of writing a book like that. If you guys would like to team up and make me lead author, I will solve your publishing problem. So we thought for a nanosecond and said, welcome, lead author. And he picked up the phone and called Simon Schuster. And that was that. So the book came out of all of our shared experiences. We were all in our 40s at the time. And it just kind of naturally flowed out of, how do you be a consultant? How do you advise people? How do you get people to take your advice? You know, how do you sell also in that kind of environment? You know, so the book, it wasn't like a decision to write it. It just was there waiting to be written. And we saw it and said, yeah, this looked cool. Let's do it.
Well, there's a couple questions that you have at the beginning of the book that says, hey, if this is the type of questions you are looking to solve, then this book is for you. And here's just a few of them. How can I access, how can I get access to my clients more often? How can I persuade my client to introduce me to others in their organization? How can I cross sell? I guess that means with like affiliates and maybe partners, but yeah. How can I avoid being typecast, labeled as a specialist only in my main discipline? What do I do about not being an expert in related fields? Ooh, that's a good one to ask. And then how do I get clients less focused on price? Probably one of the big ones. So guys, stay tuned for this. And how do I get clients to play fairly with me? Wow. These are awesome for anybody selling a service, right? Anybody who has a business. And, you know, I guess let's start off with one of the main ones there. How do I get access to my clients more often? What would you say to the individual listening?
I think all the ones that you mentioned, you're absolutely right. Those are great questions. I hadn't heard those for a while. I think in a way, the answer is the same to all of them. And I'll oversimplify just to make the point. You pay attention to them. Listen to them. Get them talking about them. Show interest in them. And stop thinking about yourself. How do I sell them? How do I influence them? How do I get them introduced me? Stop it. Just don't think that way. Glom onto something about that person and, you know, drive it. Be interested. Be curious. And guess what? Everybody loves to be paid attention to. Nobody gets enough attention, right? Everybody else is out for themselves. trying to, you know, score their little thing. So if you're that one rare person who genuinely seems to show interest in the person you're talking to, guess what the natural human response is? Oh, wow, that's cool. Let's talk some more. Let me introduce you to some of my friends. Let me, you know, I want to do more of this. Oh, that's not a bad price. We can do this. And it's amazing what happens when you just stop changing your focus from yourself and your own goals to helping other people get their stuff. This is not a new idea, by the way. This is as old as, what's his name? Win friends and influence people.
Dale Carnegie.
Yeah, Dale Carnegie. Exactly.
Well, I think that you're definitely spot on with be curious, ask questions. Really what you're doing is solving their problem. They don't care about you until you help them with their problem, right? So,
well, yes, although let me give a refinement to that. It's not that you have to solve the problem. You have to get them to agree to discuss it with you to where you can jointly, together, collaboratively define what the heck the problem is. Once you've got an agreement like that, then they become open to your solutions. If you just walk in the door with a great solution, nobody's going to buy it from you. They don't know you. They don't trust you. They have no sense of your track record, and nobody likes being told what to do. I give a simple parallel. When my daughter had her first grandchild of mine, the kid was 2 weeks old, and he got some kind of sickness, you know, and colicky and a temperature and screaming like babies do. They're new parents. What do? You know, it's freakish. You know, you're freaking out. So envision calling up the pediatrician. Scenario A, scenario B. Scenario A, you call up the pediatrician. You make an appointment. You go in. The pediatrician looks at the kid for about 30 seconds. Says, you know what? There's a lot of XYZ going around. Take these two pills. Call me in the morning. Well, if you know my overeducated, smart-ass daughter, you would not take that for an answer. You would say, wait a minute. What about WebMD? What about this other stuff I'm reading? You know, on the other hand, scenario B, if you go into the pediatrician, and most of them are trained in this, they'll say, wow, when did this start happening? What did you notice? What's most concerning to you? What does he do when you do this? What does he do when you do that? You know what? I'm thinking there's this thing XYZ going around. Let's give this a try. Take two pills and call me tomorrow, first thing, okay? Well, guess what? That's a proposition that people are going to try. And the only difference is you paid attention to them.
More questions.
I mean, you have a medical degree. That's your qualifications, but it's not that's enough to get you in the door. That's enough to get your phone number out there. It is not enough to get people to take your advice.
Wow. And the representation that you care more, right? You have a little bit more concern. You have maybe a little bit more empathy that connects with the person for them to maybe have that trigger in their brain that says, oh, this person cares more than someone who just gives me the solution.
Yeah.
And therefore, they're tailoring it to me, which means I'm going to listen to that prescription or recipe more.
Exactly. Yeah.
Ooh,
exactly.
Okay.
By the way, here's the secret to it, the trick. I think it was one of the old comedians, Groucho Marx or somebody like that. No. And one of them, George Burns. He said, the most important thing in life is sincerity. If you can fake that, you've got it made. So the trick here is you actually do have to care. You can't fake it. Once you start trying to care, you know, fake showing empathy so that you can get your sale in, you've screwed yourself. It doesn't work. I mean, on some level, you really have to be sincere, which means you've got to kind of reach deep inside yourself and say, do I give a damn about these people or not? If I don't care about them, maybe I'm in the wrong business. If I am, the rest becomes easy.
Well, one thing that I've learned from, I think it was Influence by Robert Cialdini. Have you ever read that book?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Very instrumental for my stuff, too.
Yeah, I love it. And it really did show me the importance of becoming a best-selling author, right? Writing books. It showed me how important it is to get speaking gigs, podcast interviews, because you need to create this social proof for people to trust in you. And if other people trust in you, that gives me a little bit more of the ability to trust in you, right? The market has already signed off on you. How could someone, maybe this is a great conversation we can have within my team, but individuals who are sales reps for my company, how can they get social proof or maybe talk about or build up the social proof if they are new to the company, if people don't know who they are? So if someone's out there and they're not technically a trusted advisor yet in the marketplace, how do they do that and become that?
Well, let me answer that sort of tangentially. I wrote three books. The first of them that we're talking about now is The Trusted Advisor. The other two were sort of follow-ups, Trust-Based Selling and The Trusted Advisor Field Book. On each of those, we use name publishers. Macmillan, Simon Schuster, and I'm forgetting a third. And I had three different publicists, and two of them were terrible, and one of them was great. The terrible ones were old school. You line up book tours, you put out advertisements, you get radio interviews, you get press interviews, blah, 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 blah. It didn't really make much of a difference. The third one used to work for Tom Peters, and then he went off on his own, and he started advising authors on publishing their books, how to get known. And his advice was fabulous. He said, start a year ahead of time. Get all over LinkedIn. Make a list of the 300 people you want to buy your book and promote it. Start following those people. Comment on their blog posts. Comment on their LinkedIn posts. Act like you love them. Love them up. Because anybody who publishes, you know, it's gold when somebody actually reaches out and comments. You want that. Yeah. Well, guess what? If you make that a habit for a year and you comment on somebody's post 6 or 7 or 8 times, then when you finally go and say, hey, this has been great this past year. By the way, I have a new book coming out. Would you mind? Heck no, they don't mind at all. Robert Cialdini talks about the returning favors.
Law of reciprocity almost, right?
The reciprocity thing is the gold nugget in that book. One of the basic rules of human behavior. We give like for like, you know, good for good, bad for bad. If you're angry at me, I'm going to be angry at you. If you're afraid of me, I'm going to be afraid of you. If I respect you, you're going to respect me. If I trust you, you're more likely to trust me.
Ooh.
So, you know, I think you can apply that to your reps, you know, get to know the people you're talking to.
Oh.
Become a trusted, never say you're a trusted advisor. Never call yourself that. Let other people call that. You behave that way so that people recognize it. And again, we're back to the basic behavior. Focus on other people, not yourself.
Man, it is the law of physics also. Everybody's worried about that outcome, right? But what you can only control is the input, right? Every action has a reaction. So if you want attention, start giving attention, start liking, commenting, promoting others. What a nugget right there. If you do that, like you said, like if you become a promoter of others, people are going to promote you. It's just nature.
Right. Yeah, it is.
Man, great, great. I hope my sales team's watching this. Just saying, that's a habit. Also,
I can tell them where they can find it.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I'll be sharing it with them. But number six, you talk about, and this is something that I sometimes struggle with because I'm not a sales trainer. I'm a cowboy. I can kind of go off of emotion and show what is important, but to teach it to others, very difficult. So when it comes to getting clients less focused on price, my philosophy is you have to show the return on investment. You got to show what will come from it and maybe paint the vision. As a great leader, any great leader, you really paint the vision of what's possible. And hey, let's go there together. Here are the tools and resources. So what would you say to somebody? What's inside this book?
Well, I think that answer, which is not uncommon, is about half right.
Okay.
The other half, I don't know, half, whatever. The other one is that most people, when they are concerned about price, they're raising it because that's not the real issue. That's the socially acceptable thing to talk about. If you're going to break up with somebody, you know, it's not you, it's me. Well, price is the version of that. Your price is a little too high. No, you know, it's really not. So underlying all of that is this combative component that we all impose on ourselves when we're in sales mode. How do I get them to agree with me? How do I overcome their objections? You know, I reply, well, overcoming is the wrong concept. You need to get on the same side of the table with them, not on opposite sides. You should be glad that people are pushing back on you. They're objecting. Objecting is a good thing. They're still engaged. The real problem is they're not engaged at all. So what you do in the case of price, and again, this is coming out of background complex intangible sales, again, like lawyers or legal services or accountants or whatever. And if somebody says, gee, you know, your price is kind of high, what you do instead of fighting back and saying, look at the value, all that stuff, you say, kind of high. Help me understand what you mean by that. Because in my experience, I've found 4 or 5 different things that people mean when they say that. Sometimes they mean it's higher than they thought, or it's higher than their budget, or it's higher than a quote they got from a competitor. Or maybe they just never take the first price quote. They always want to borrow. I don't know. You know. So when you say the price feels a little high, help me understand what you mean by that. And maybe we can solve it and maybe we can't. But let's explore it together. So what you've done, you said implicitly, I am not fighting with you. We are discussing a common problem to find out whether we can find an agreement on the issue of price. You take them seriously, in other words, instead of, you know, fighting this fake fight of whether the price is too high or low. And you get on the same side of the table and say, let's figure it out. Maybe we can, maybe we can't. You know, this is meant to be, maybe it's not meant to be, but let's find out together. So it reframes the price question. And yes, also, by the way, shows you're not out to get them. You're not trying to sell them.
Got it. Got it. And so when I hear that, like you said, it's like the fallback. That's a lie. Let me think about it. I got to figure out how to work it in.
Yeah.
It's the automatic response 90% of the time, whether it is high or it isn't. That's the easy letdown that allows them to walk away, right? And so I do believe this is to be true. And maybe sometimes it's worth the fight and worth maybe it's not. But maybe individuals at the subconscious level respect those who don't just hear that and say, oh, okay, see you later then. They say, if they hear you ask the question, well, what do you mean by that? It almost gives them some type of respect for you to say it's not just give up. Oh, you're willing to fight for, maybe now it's not a fight, but it's willing to defend their price.
Right. Yeah.
Is there something that's going on there?
Yeah, I think, again, price is a socially acceptable version of like breaking off something. Like, say you ask out the prettiest girl in high school, right? And she says, oh, I'm busy Friday night. Well, if you're smart, you get the message. Oops, not going to work. Thanks a lot. See you later.
Yeah.
If you're dumb, you say, well, what about Saturday night? What about Monday? What about Tuesday? And eventually you will learn. She wasn't busy Friday night. The problem is you. But if you've taken it, you know, again, if you flip that, that's the usual way in which price plays out. It's used as a weapon, a socially acceptable weapon by both parties to talk around what the real issue is, whatever that may be. The truth is, 9 times out of 10, if you really find agreement with the client about what the problem is, and in the discussions, it seems like you know what you're talking about, you're not trying to blow smoke up them, and you're not trying to get something over on them, they become interested and they begin to talk with you. And the more they talk with you, the more they realize, wow, this guy knows what he's talking about. Let's do this. How much do you cost? Yeah. Oh, wow, that's kind of high. Good for you. And suddenly, you know, it's not an issue.
To be a trusted advisor and to kind of piggyback off of that example, how much does persistence play into someone's psyche that, hey, these people have been around, they've been, you know, trying to get me on a call. They're still willing to, you know, explain their system to me. How much does persistence add to being a trusted advisor? And the reason why I bring that up is because I've been in that situation with the girl who turned me down and then turn me down and then turn me down, but it didn't affect my morale. And it took a couple of years, but she finally said yes. So, to me, it pays off. Now that is a shot in the dark and it doesn't happen all the time, but there are people who've turned me down even in business that came around a year later and said, you know what, now I'm ready. And it's probably because they didn't have all the check boxes. Who have you been around? How many books have you done? Do I trust that you're going to be here a year from now? So like, maybe I need to check off those boxes a little bit more. So persistence, is that a crucial part to being a trusted advisor?
I think it's a little bit overrated, apart from the romantic area where I respect that. I mean, I think persistence says a lot, you know, knowing that somebody's really genuinely interested in you. Maybe they don't get that the first time, or they don't believe it, or they're skeptical, but you kept at it. And the message you sent was, hey, I am interested in you. I care about you. Well, transfer that feeling over to sales. I can't tell you how many damned emails every day I get from LinkedIn saying, I want to connect. And I'm finally writing back, why? You know, give me a good reason. I'm not buying anything and I'm not trying to sell anything. But if I can help you, fine. You know, now give me a reason. And you know what? They never come up with a reason. Oh, you're well-respected, you know stuff in the field, it'd be good to connect. I don't want another connection, for Christ. I'm not collecting connections anymore. And they wimp out because, in fact, they were just trying to hustle something. They're trying to sell me something. So they didn't care about me. It's obvious from the beginning. So that's where I think the comparison falls down. Persistence in romance, I'm a fan of it. Persistence in sales, by the time I get, gee, maybe you missed my first email. No, I didn't. I saw the thing and I didn't reply because you're a waste of time. Get off my case.
Yeah.
I mean, those people go onto my block list and my junk list because I don't want to hear from them again. So I don't think it works as well.
Yeah, and I do agree with the aspect of not chasing down people who are not interested. Right. And I guess maybe just keep doing your thing and they'll come back around if they are looking for that. Or maybe the problem becomes so big in their life that you're top of mind. Maybe they see the emails, they're just not ready. But just, I guess, withstanding the storms gives you a lot of social proof on its own. Being around for 5 years, it's as if you are the go-to source, and maybe that's what also creates the trusted
advisor. I think there's something to it, but I think, here's what I think people should be doing in terms of online sales and marketing. It's really dirt simple. Instead of, hiring some guy with the latest mailing list and you use AI to craft your messages and all that stuff and target people beautifully, don't do that. Go to their LinkedIn, find out first who you want to talk to. Agreed. Find a few, not 100, find a few target clients. And look them up on LinkedIn and write to them and say, wow, I read that blog post you read 2 months ago. I just ran across it. It's dynamite. Here's what I loved about it. Here's what I don't understand about it. Would you mind explaining this to me? Well, who's not going to answer that?
Oh,
they just
have
great interest in you. You've already impressed me by, you know about my book. You read the foreword. You know the three authors. I mean, you're miles ahead of most people.
Jeez, you're easy.
Well, it's not hard. You just show interest in something. How would you like to have somebody show interest in you? They don't do it by saying, oh, I got a neat offering. Maybe you'd be interested. No, not particularly. Maybe, maybe not, but not with that intro. On the other hand, if you lead with me, not you, you got my attention. It's not hard.
And there's
By the way, LinkedIn is a rich target environment. There's all kinds of, all you have to do is say, gee, I see you're in Minneapolis. Did you get away from that storm last night? It looked horrible. Were you in the path of it? Or you live out by Twin Lakes and you maybe missed it. Wow. Right there. It's the equivalent of commenting on somebody's, new shoes or something. It shows you're actually paying attention.
That's a great piece, right? Curiosity is a superpower. Asking questions and showing interest. You do that authentically, man, right. You are one step ahead of every single one of your competitors. That's great.
And it's not that hard.
So Jordan Peterson has a great quote, and he says that life is a series of games, and the way to win lots of games is to be invited to play lots of games, right? And so in number 7 in your book, it says, how do I get clients to play fairly with me? I think it starts with a culture, with a certain maybe representation of your core values, showing people that you are there for them, right? I changed my message in 2017, 2018. I went from just, hey, does anybody need a book? We can help you, to does anybody with a business need a book? And that little shift started to open up my world with the right people, the right demographics. And yeah. I guess that gave me some, standing within the relationship that we'd build that, okay, I'm right for you. You're right for me. We both know that. And I'm a no-nonsense guy based off of what I post on social media. So they know that I don't hold back, which I think is how I was able to maybe build relationships faster. And yeah. That's how I was able to get people to play fairly with me. So What is your recommendation?
I think that's pretty much on the money. There's I'll give an analogy from the trust field. I don't remember the guy's name, but he was in the cabinet of Franklin Roosevelt, President Roosevelt. And he had this line, which has become sort of famous. He said, the fastest way to make somebody trustworthy is to trust them. Because go back to reciprocity, Cialdini, people reciprocate. So most people, when they come to talk to me about trust, they're talking about trustworthiness. How do I appear trustworthy to my clients? And that's important, don't get me wrong, but the trustworthiness is a passive virtue. You sit around and look trustworthy and wait for, it's like in sales, aggressively waiting for the phone to ring. You don't have to aggressively wait for the phone to ring. You can ring the phone yourself. And you do that by finding ways to trust other people. That then triggers, oh, this is an honorable person. They're doing their best. Wow, they're trusting me. And guess what? It ups their game. Again, reciprocity. So, an example of that, I'll give you a metaphor first. Let's say you're invited out to dinner with a potential client of yours. You've never been to dinner at their house before, so this is kind of upping the social stakes, right? And you and your wife, you're driving there, and what do? You stop at a liquor store and you buy a nice bottle of wine. That's what you do. You're supposed to do that. You don't even get much credit for it. You get there, you get the wine, oh, thank you, that's so nice of you, blah, 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 blah. All right, big deal. Now, What if instead you said, you know what? I think last summer they went to Italy on vacation. I think they were in the Piemonte region. What if we got them a beautiful bottle of Barolo and wrapped it up in strings, the colors of the Italian flag? That'd be cool, wouldn't it? Now, that's risky because A, you don't, maybe for all you know, they're alcoholics. Or
yeah,
maybe you got it wrong. Maybe they went to Spain. So most of us would say, it's not worth the risk. You know, we'll just get the regular bottle of wine. However, the truth is you get credit for taking those risks by trusting them. Each of those scenarios has probably happened before. If they are alcoholics, this isn't the first time. And they'll say something like, that's so kind of you. We don't drink, but we'll save that for our friends who do. Maybe you'd like some of it now. Can we open it up for you? Or if they went to Spain, you know, and you make a little joke, Spain, Italy, they're both in the South. It's all the same. You know, it's you get credit for having taken a risk. And the essence of trusting is taking a risk on somebody. Variation on the theme would be, you know, in an early meeting, you say, you know, I've never worked with a business exactly like yours. And certainly, you know, more about your business than I do. But I got to wonder, if I were in your shoes, I would be thinking about X as being a big problem. Is that right? Now, there's only two answers and they're both good. If they say, wow, X is absolutely the right problem. What do you got to share with that? Well, that's a nice one. The other one's even better. That's when they say, oh, everybody thinks X is the problem, but no, it's Y. In which case you say, oh my God, the minute you said that, I realized how right you are. Tell me more about why. And they love it, right? Because they get to talk about themselves and how much smarter they are than you. And you sit there and support it, you know, and you learn something while you're at it.
Oh, man.
So I'm looking at ways to trust your client.
My God, that's going to be such great ammunition. But just once you master it, understand it, it's really, you're not faking it. You're actually doing it on purpose to be right. Like a detective. The way I look at it is when I meet with potential clients, I'm sort of a detective. All right, where are you at now? Where were you? And where are you trying to go? And what's the problem? And then I formulate my conversation based off of what they've given me. And that's sort of just inside of me since I've been in sales for many years. But to educate that to someone who is not in the sales world or who hasn't been doing it for a long time, it's very difficult. But you put it so eloquently. So really nice job on that. But you're talking about trust more than anything, how to build trust really fast. And I'm looking at one of your figures, I think in chapter 2 or chapter 1, and it talks about how there are four stages: service-based, needs-based, relationship-based, and then trust-based. Man, when I look at that, I'm like, oh yeah, we're a service-based business in one aspect, but in another aspect, I'm needs-based. And then I look at some other part of my business, I'm like, well, that's relationship-based. And then I'm thinking of all my really fast clients were all based off of just trust. Hey, this person trusts you. I trust you. Let's do business. Done.
Yeah.
So when I'm looking at this, is it really all about going from one stage to the next, to the next, to the next, and ultimately ending up in becoming everybody's a trust-based business, period?
Well, it's, that particular graphic, it's, I'm interested and flattered that you like that it works for you. It was meant to be more descriptive than prescriptive. And yet I do find some clients trying to automate it, you know, and assign and make a competency model. What are the behaviors associated with each step? Don't go there. Just, you know, let this be a descriptor after the fact of where you're at, or maybe a diagnostic once in a while. It's not so much a prescription. I think if you focus on the fundamentals of paying attention to the client, asking questions is part of it, a big part. But the other part is don't forget to ask how they feel about being in that situation and what it's like for them and what is important to them. You worried about losing your job? You worried about, you know, not getting promoted? What's your concern about the issues here? And make sure it's connected. Trust, it turns out, is partly rational and partly non-rational, partly emotional. And the easy parts that most people recognize are the credibility and reliability components. Those are highly quantifiable. You can put metrics in place. You can track it. You can diagnose it. You can compare it. You can get the ROI out of it. Intimacy and self-orientation, the other two parts of what we call the trust equation, those are much more emotional. They're like, how long do you focus your eyes on theirs? How firm is the handshake? How quickly do you nod? Are you paying attention or not? And these are things that we're all highly tuned. I mean, we're the result of millions of years of evolution. We all have these tons of instincts and gut feels, which we mostly shut down because you're supposed to just think rationally. But the fact is, we're rational creatures, but we're also non-rational creatures. And we play off that every single day. You walk by somebody down the street, you get a look from them. You know what that look means or doesn't mean. And we know that intuitively. So I one thing I found, we've done some videotape role play exercises and little skits, and I'll show an audience of 50 people, you know, what did that guy do wrong right there? Did you all have the same reaction? Yep. 70% of the hands go up. What did he do wrong? 70% of the people, 80%, 90% agree. This is what's going on. My God, they're all pros. I could get a bunch of accountants to agree with that faster than they can agree on one of the generally accepted accounting principles. You know, they get into debate. We all are endowed with pretty good gut feel, but we don't use it. And so all this stuff, the emotional side of things, is very gut feel based, very art based, if you will, non-science based, if you will. And we should rely on it more, like the reciprocity thing. That makes intuitive sense to people when you explain it, right? And you don't need advanced physics or anything to describe how people behave. We all know how people behave. We just forget to look at it that way, right?
Mm-hmm. So I am always trying to obviously establish trust as fast as possible, but depending on where I'm at and who I'm talking to, it might be different. Whether right. I'm on a podcast or in front of a person on a Zoom call or on stage, there are right. probably universal ways of establishing trust really fast. And yeah. when I get on a stage, one of the ways that I've kind of, approached this is when I tell a joke right out of the gate, I let the guard, I let the helium out of the balloon, or I let the air right. out. I make it a little bit more comfortable. That's one way of getting them to listen and pay right. attention and maybe trust me as like a person rather than just a business, if you will. So
absolutely.
Is there maybe one, two, or three recommendations on how to establish trust within the first 5 or 10 minutes, no matter what medium it is?
Yeah. When I do keynote speeches, I learned a long time ago, I make sure all the advertising, all the promotions, all the signage, all this stuff says Harvard MBA, 20 years management consulting, author of 3 books, 500,000 copies sold. That's all credibility and credentials. That's what I suggest you lead with. Before you meet people, they learn about your bio. That's why doctors put up their degrees in the office, wear the white coats, all that stuff.
Got it.
But then when you get face to face, because the most powerful form of trust is not, you know, credentializing or institutions, it's personal. The first thing I do, like you, I tell a story about myself and how I screwed up and what an idiot I was, right? So you humanize yourself immediately.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
that's a great, humor is a great way to do that. A couple other quick hits in that vein. A great way to establish trust is if you don't know the answer to something, say, I don't know, and let it sit there. Because who's going to doubt you on that? Nobody's going to doubt. When you say you don't know, you're telling the truth.
Yeah.
How many people have the courage to tell the truth? All the people that I work with, they're so afraid of looking stupid or ill-informed or unsmart that they keep tap dancing around to try and come up with a sort of good enough answer. And it's just obfuscation. It falls flat. If you're willing to be the person that says, that one, I don't know. You know, if that's really important, let's get into it. Is it really important? Help me understand. But put your foot right out there. I don't know. It's one of the most credibility enhancing things you can say.
Wow. Yeah. Rather than just bullshit your way through an answer.
Right. Absolutely.
People trust in your honesty more and they respect you because of it.
That's right. Because the person who has the courage to say, I don't know, is a person who seems to be comfortable in themselves, not afraid of admitting they don't know certain things. They're just saying, hey, I'm not God. Everybody else claims they are. They're bullshitters. You know, I'm not. That's the message you're sending. You're comfortable with yourself. And then immediately gives people a feeling, oh, he's not going to BS me. He's going to be straight with me.
Mm. And you're also making me think of some ways to really destroy the trust in the marketplace. And yep. I believe, and maybe this is a weird way of saying this, but somebody could absolutely do no wrong, right? But
yep.
their trust is eroded in the marketplace by who they're surrounding themselves with.
Yep,
I know
true.
This person's shady. I know this person's shady. Uh-oh. I didn't know you were shady, but just by hanging around them, I don't know if I want to invest or be a part of it. So yeah. I don't trust you like I once did. That's one way, right? I mean, that's a natural instinct. Maybe that's a gut instinct like you're talking about at the subconscious level. So is there maybe one common denominator that you've noticed other people really destroy their trust? Probably not keeping their word, but anything that you would say, do not do this, because I've seen this happen many times.
Well, I remember once the firm that I ran, we developed a policy around pricing. We only discount for like two reasons. One, if it was a public sector, we gave discounts for that. And the other one was volume discounts, because those are economic savings to us. And we would tell people we don't cut prices for any other reasons than those. So if a client would come up and say, well, okay, let's do this thing. By the way, can you give us a better price on that? And I would give them the speech, no, we can't, because one of the things we teach is don't lie. And I've just made it public to the world, we don't cut prices. And sorry, you're not a government agency and you're not buying multiple sessions. So no. And interestingly enough, people respect that. Well, once I made the mistake, there was a guy called me up. We had a great chat. It was going to be a great fit. And I told him about this, you know, approach to price. And he said, this sounds great. I'm still not sure though. And I said, what would it take? What would I have to bring the price down to? Totally undercut my own message. And he called me on it right there. He said, you just contradicted yourself. You just gave me this great speech about how you never cut prices, and then you offered to cut price. He said, from here on, I don't believe anything you say.
Oh, man.
Well, I never made that mistake again.
If you say something again.
Yeah.
So, he never moved forward with you then, huh?
No, he didn't. I give him credit. I mean, he's right. He caught me doing wrong. He called me out on it. I don't blame him one bit for calling it off. And I learned the lesson.
Okay. So the message that you're preaching, you do not break from it, because right. Number one, you will see yourself in the mirror as a liar, but others are noticing it too.
That's right.
Oh, that's man. Right. And I'm telling you, when you walk into a room, and let's just say not everybody signs up, but if you walk into a room and you have the backbone that say, we don't cut prices, and you stick to it, you most likely hold yourself to a high standard everywhere you go. You walk with more confidence, right? They gauge it in your energy and your tonality.
And they respect it too, because they sort of know it's a good argument. Most of the clients I deal with, they do cut prices all the time. And their backroom negotiations are, let's kick it up to the price committee. And they end up with some stupid. And they say, why are you doing that? First of all, you're giving up tons of money by cutting your prices all the time. Second, you look like you quote one thing and then deliver another. You're undercutting your trust right away. Stop it. No. They get that. They sort of think, that's not a bad policy. Maybe we should do that.
Oh man, that's a great way to say it too, is that, you know, when you say something to the marketplace and you offer a certain product for a price, do not change it. Do not break away from it, because words travel pretty damn fast, and you don't want to be walking into a room and looking over your shoulder. Who's here? Who did you talk to? And that just kills the spirit once you start worrying about what you said to somebody else, right? And it's almost like you never have to remember what you said if you always told the truth. That's it.
That's right. The great thing about telling the truth, you only have to remember one version of it.
That's great.
You know, one other thought, if we got a second here.
Yeah, please.
Given the direction that we're talking here, my favorite book of the three that I wrote was the second one, called Trust-Based Selling. It's the only one I wrote solely by myself. That's not why I like it. It's because I think sales is the most powerful area in which trust really shows up. And I love sales examples. And I think 95% of the sales market out there, the sales community, does it wrong from the get-go. Here's what I mean by that. If you go to read any sales book, any sales training program, it is full of, here's how you raise your income, here's how you increase your leads, here's how you can close more deals, you know, here's how you can da 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 da. Well, guess who that's all about? It's all about the seller. Mm-hmm. None of it is about the customer, including all the people that talk about customer focus and all that. 95% of them say customer focus so you can make more money. That's the customer focus of a vulture. A vulture is customer focused, but not for the right reasons. So instead, here's the best example. Let's say you have to go out and you have to buy some complicated, expensive service you don't know much about. Maybe you're, you know, finding a medical facility for your parents, or maybe you're getting an HVAC system put in your house, or you're buying a vacation property, or you're trying to find a lawyer to do wills and estates and stuff. They know more than you do. It's expensive. It's important to you. And you don't have any way of judging. And let's say you run across somebody who, in all your interactions with them, seems to focus on you, not them. They're not giving you any deadlines. They're comfortable with whatever deadline you have. They don't seem like they're out to get the sale. They seem to be helpful along the way. They seem to be knowledgeable. Isn't that who you'd like to buy from? Somebody who behaves that way. And everybody nods their head just like you are right now. Yes, that's who we'd like to buy from. Well, if that's who you'd like to buy from, maybe you should sell that way.
That's it.
Right?
That's yeah. It.
That's really it. Just behave that way. Be curious. Don't be attached to the outcome, like you said earlier. Just focus on the inputs. Do the right thing. Pay attention and recognize that you may not get this particular sale, but if you behave that way consistently, you will get more than your share of sales. You may not know which one, but that's okay. Play the long game. Play the odds.
I come from the corporate space. To some degree. I mean, I was an entrepreneur, then I had to clear up some debt. So I went back into the corporate space and became a sales rep. And all they taught was fast, hard closing, right? And it was, there's a process there. And it really felt weird doing certain techniques that did not fit my DNA. And it's not how I bought, right? So though I did it, it didn't feel right. And there would be a lot of people who say yes, because I could put on the pressure if I want, but then they would think about it and then cancel. Right. And always make it bad taste in my mouth. So when I built this business, I always say to even the people who are on my team, hey, I'm a soft closer. I want to just provide things to the individual. And if they say yes, they say yes, but the hard closing techniques we will not adopt here. So I'm assuming, depending on the environment, it's just becoming more common to say, oh, this is how this person sells. Let me adopt that hard closing technique. But if it doesn't fit the DNA of the sales rep or the leader of the company, it's not going to work. Am I right?
Well, I would argue, unless you're selling pet rocks, you know, from some shop in Korea or something, or it's a, you know, $1.99 item, it doesn't work for anybody. It's just, it's bad because you're trying to manipulate people into getting what you want, not them. It really doesn't work for much of anyone. So the challenge is I have to kind of get rid of the lexicon of closing. You know, ABC, always be closing. No, always be curious. That's a better ABC.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, we're agreeing on that one.
Glenn Ross, I think that's what
that's
it is, right?
That's
yeah,
right,
everybody watched that and they said, oh, I'm going to be just like that. Always be closing.
Doesn't work. Doesn't
so
work.
I was a janitor while I was starting my first couple businesses. I had to take some night shifts as a janitor to stay afloat. And there was this law firm, and it was funny. I remember walking into this law firm to clean the actual garbage cans every night with the bags. And there was a huge sign over the coffee machine. Coffee is for closers at the law firm.
Right out of the movie. Yeah. I remember I worked for another law firm that, they approached me like they usually do. Trusted advisor sounds good to that. And it turns out they had a slogan in that firm. They did a lot of corporate injury stuff, and their saying was, "Mold is gold." Meaning they did a lot of mold cases, you know, and mold is gold. Made a lot of money on mold stuff. Well, just what are their motives, you know?
Yeah,
I forget the guy's name, but back in the 70s or something, one of the managing partner of Goldman Sachs, he had a great saying. He said, "We are long term selfish. We like money. We love money. We want to be rich. But we're going to do it long term, not on a transactional basis. We're going to get there by doing the right thing by our customers." And they believe me, but they used to. I think they've gone away from that since then. But at the time, I think that was a pretty noble sentiment. Nothing wrong with being rich, but we're going to get rich the right way by doing right by our customers.
And being honest about it. We're here to make money, but not all in one bite. I like
that. Right.
Man, this has been fun to talk with you. Outside, the last question I have for you, outside of your own books, is there one that maybe you recommend to our audience? It sounds like you already gave us a few recommendations. So is there one that stands above the rest that you would say, hey, if you're going to read about being a trusted advisor, I also recommend this book. What would that be?
I haven't thought about that. You know, a good candidate would be that we mentioned, Robert Cialdini.
Good deal.
The book's about 30 years old at this point, still good. Cialdini, at least in that book, he's moderated a little bit since then, but there's a slight overtone of manipulativeness in that book. If you can forgive him that, just strip it out of your mind and notice the dynamics that he's talking about. It is a profound book, just a really good book, and you've seen it too.
Yeah.
So I'd go with that one.
Yeah, it's a top five in my opinion. If you guys have not read it, Robert Cialdini's Influence. He has another one that's out there. I think it's Persuasive or Persuasion, something like that. But Influence is by far his best. Anyways, guys, the book that he was just talking about is called Trust-Based Selling. And this is his book, Using Customer Focus and Collaboration to Build Long-Term Relationships. And the one we were referencing before is The Trusted Advisor. I think, did you say 500,000 copies were sold?
I think so. It's really, it's really hard to tell from publishers' records, but somewhere between that and a million over 20 some years. Yeah.
Amazing. So really well done. Is there a website or a social media channel that you recommend? Yeah. I think I saw something in the notes about, I believe, is it the Trusted Advisor? Anyways, what website is best?
Website is trustedadvisor.com. That's spelled with an O-R at the end. TrustedAdvisor.com. And I do some stuff on LinkedIn. I kind of stopped doing Twitter or X. So the main thing is the website. There's a bunch of good stuff there. Videos, 15 years of blog posts, articles, a self-assessment tool. It's kind of fun to look around. Trustedadvisor.com.
Man, you were right at the cusp, because to get trustedadvisor.com is an awesome domain. And so I commend you for picking that one up, because right around 2000, you might have picked it up, because it seems like that's when the domains were starting to go.
That's right.
Off it the was shelf easy pretty then. Fast.
It was easy then. Yep.
Well, Charlie Green, thank you so much for being here. It's been fun to talk with you. The nuggets that you dropped are phenomenal.
Thank you very much.
And come back on whenever you have another book out there to promote, because we love talking with you, okay?
All right, man. Thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
Remember, guys, the $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life right on.